Im Jahr des 275. Jubiläums der Göttinger Universität befasst sich die Ringvorlesung mit der Geschichte der Georgia Augusta und wirft auch einen Blick in die Zukunft. Am 3. Juli sprach der Hamburger Physiker Brian Forster über Einsteins Universe. Die Einführung kam vom Göttinger Physiker Arnulf Quadt.
Lieber Herr Kern, lieber Arnulf, meine sehr geehrte Damen und Herren, es ist ein großer Vergnügen, hier in Göttingen zu sein, ein sehr historischer Platz für Physik. Ich bin schon dreimal hier und habe immer eine sehr gute Zeit gehabt. Also wir sind froh, dass wir hier sein können, und jetzt spreche ich wieder auf Englisch. Ich glaube, es würde mehr verständlich sein, wenn ich auf Englisch spreche. We're here to tell you about a very extraordinary man, Albert Einstein, perhaps the world's greatest scientist, at any rate a man who was not just a scientist, but had an enormous hinterland, as we say, a man who loved music, and there you see him in perhaps an unusual picture playing the violin. He often said that he'd had more pleasure in his life from playing the violin than from anything else. So his story is one which touches the development and our understanding of the universe from a period when, according to Lord Kelvin, a famous British physicist, everything about physics was already understood, to an era where we know how little we understand. Einstein was a key figure in that development, and this lecture will tell you about his life and his science, how music affected his life, how it affected his science, how he formed the cornerstone of our understanding of modern science. I will take you through his life with some of his science and how he understood and made enormous progress in our understanding of the universe. And then in the second half of the lecture, I will tell you about how we're trying to fulfill his legacy by colliding particles at ultra-high energies to try to understand the deepest workings of the universe at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. The lecture will be interspersed by some of the music which Einstein loved. He loved the music of Bach and Mozart. And just when you're feeling very tired by my explanation, Jack will refresh you by playing some of that music. So we'll begin with a slideshow which will tell you about Einstein's life, both in science and in music. And to accompany that, Jack will play for you some of his favorite music. He loved the music of Bach and Mozart, and in particular, Jack will play for you several excerpts from the pinnacle of the repertoire for the solo violin, the 6 sonatas and partitas by Johann Sebastian Bach. And to begin with, Jack will play for you the saraband from the 2nd partita.
Thank you.
You saw from the slideshow that Einstein's career began in a rather unusual way for a physicist. I was a patent officer, third class, in the sleepy medieval city of Bern. Switzerland at that time was going through a revolution, unlikely as that sounds. It wasn't, of course, a political revolution, but rather a revolution of technology. And the new technology is shown on the slide, that of railways. Switzerland, of course, is a very mountainous country, and travel between the major cities was very difficult. In the medieval period, it would take several days to travel between Zurich and Bern, for example. So it didn't matter that for most of that medieval period, the clocks in Zurich and Bern were different by 20 minutes. Only when railways began to run between those two cities did it matter, since it would be very embarrassing to arrive in Zurich before you'd left Bern. It became therefore important to synchronize clocks, not only between different cities, but also within the same city, because nothing is more irritating than to run for a train and discover the clock you looked at was 10 minutes slow. So it became very important to synchronize clocks, something which to us nowadays sounds entirely trivial. If you want to know the time, you get your handy out and you look at it, and there it tells you. But imagine the situation in the very late part of the 19th century when Einstein first arrived in Bern. How would you synchronize the clock by which the trains run with the clock which can be seen from many of the localities of the city? What he actually did was that the porter of the railway would look at the time, he would walk along to the end of this platform, and a man with a telescope was stationed in the tower. The porter would semaphore to him what the time was. The man in the clock would write it down, he would run up to the clock face and turn the hand so that they agreed with what he'd written down. By that time, of course, it was several minutes slow. So actually, the process of synchronizing clocks is not a trivial one. And indeed, just before Einstein arrived, the city fathers of Bern were very proud to unveil a new system to synchronize all of the clocks in Bern. It worked beautifully. A central location produced an electric impulse down some very thick cables, which went all the way to each of the big clocks in the city. When the impulse arrived, the clocks were synchronized, and they were indeed correct. It worked extremely well, but it was extremely expensive. And in fact, during that period, the search to find simpler ways and cheaper ways to synchronize clocks was a substantial part of Einstein's work in the patent office. More than half of his patents were related to the problem of time and synchronization. So at this point in his career, Einstein was thinking very deeply about time and what it meant. He got the idea for the special theory of relativity when he walked from his house. Here is the very simple, unpretentious place where he lived with his wife and two children in the Kramgasse medieval square in Bern. It was a 10-minute walk to the patent office from his flat, which you can still visit, by the way. I visited it recently. As he walked to the patent office, he passed under another of the great medieval clocks of Bern, perhaps the most important, 15th century clock. There you see the dial which tells the time. Down here, a dial which tells the phases of the moon and the signs of the zodiac. There is the arch under which Einstein walked on his way to work. At this period in his life, he thought very deeply about physics in terms of what he called thought experiments, experiments which you could do in your mind, but not necessarily build apparatus to do in the laboratory. And one morning, as he was passing under the arch, he posed a question. What would happen, he thought, if I could ride the light rays coming from the face of the clock? For several days, he thought about the answer to this question. And when he finally came up with an answer to his satisfaction, that answer changed our view of the universe forever. Imagine, as Einstein did, leaving the face of the clock by some impossible mechanism, but nevertheless you can think about doing it, tied somehow to the rays of light leaving the surface of the clock. As he recedes into outer space, looking back through a telescope at the face of the clock, the question he asked is what he would see. The rays of light which were in his eye as he leaves the clock remain in his eye because he's traveling at the same speed as they are. The rays of light 1 second later will never reach his eye. As he recedes into outer space, the hands of the clock appear forever frozen in time. Time appears to stand still. This idea that the flow of time depends on the relative motion through space is not only highly peculiar, it overthrew the worldview of Newton, who 2 centuries before had taught that space and time were entirely separate. No matter what you did in terms of space, how fast you traveled, how slowly you traveled, whether you were on your head or standing up, nothing could affect the flow of time, which went on in a way which was completely unchanged by anything that went on in space. Einstein, to the contrary, showed that in fact time and space are intimately connected by what he called the space-time continuum. This theory of special relativity implies not only that all sorts of strange things, but in particular, as we've seen, that the faster you travel, the slower time seems to pass. And that is not just an idle speculation. We can measure it with very simple apparatus. Indeed, many schools in the United Kingdom work on a little experiment where you take a scintillator which flashes when particles pass through it. They measure the cosmic rays which are passing through us as we sit in this room. Many thousands per second are generated by the collisions of high energy particles in the upper part of the Earth's atmosphere. We can measure their speed, and we can measure how long they live, and we indeed see, as Einstein predicted, that the faster they're traveling, the longer they appear to live. The slower time seems to pass for them. Relativity also tells us something else particularly important and interesting, and it will be the only equation I will use in the lecture tonight, an equation beloved of physicists because they think that most people in the audience will have heard of it. E equals mc squared, here written in Einstein's own handwriting, tells us that energy and mass are just different aspects of the same phenomenon, that mass can in principle be converted into energy. This factor c squared, c times c, is an extraordinary large number, the velocity of light squared. It tells us that if we can succeed in converting energy mass into energy, the energy released even from a tiny amount of mass is enormous, and that of course is the basis for nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Einstein realized in 1905, when, as Arnulf told us, he published the remarkable papers which established his reputation, that relativity was limited. It was only valid for observers moving at constant speed. But to get near to the velocity of light, you need to accelerate remarkably fast. And that acceleration is not taken into account by special relativity. So for the next 10 years, Einstein worked very hard trying to generalize the theory of relativity. And indeed, he succeeded and produced what with great originality he called the theory of general relativity, by which he had two major insights. And here are those insights. The first is one which you will have experienced. If you've been in a lift which starts to move very quickly, you can experience a force which seems to counteract that of gravity, pushing you upwards. That is just an illustration of the equivalence of acceleration and gravity. The second insight, perhaps more profound, was to realize that gravity could be explained as a deformation of the space-time continuum which Einstein had produced when he thought of special relativity. The picture shows a schematic view of the space-time continuum shown as the blue squares. In space without any matter, that is flat. When you come into the vicinity of a very large object, a very massive object such as the Sun, then the space-time continuum is deformed. And particles or planets such as the Earth see that deformation in the space-time continuum and follow it around in orbits. And it was that orbit prediction by Einstein which in fact gave rise to the thing which was first observed in 1919 in the eclipse of the Sun and gave verification of the general theory of relativity. So having succeeded in completely changing and revolutionizing our view of the universe, many physicists would have been content to rest on their laurels, but Einstein was not made of common fiber. He also revolutionized our understanding of another completely different mechanism, that of quantum mechanics, our view of how atoms and subatomic particles behave. The ancient Greeks had known, or rather hypothesized, the existence of atoms, the indivisible particles which make up everything we see around us. It was not until a discovery not far from here in Würzburg that Röntgen discovered X-rays, the first indication that perhaps the Greeks were wrong and that atoms could in fact have a structure. It was then that people began to study the question of the structure of atoms, and the quantum hypothesis, which Arnulf mentioned, was indeed the founding prediction of what we call quantum mechanics. The basic prediction of quantum mechanics is one which is highly surprising. It says that there is no certainty in our understanding of how the atom behaves. An individual atom will always behave in a random process. All we can do, even with the very best predictions in physics, is to predict on average what many thousands or millions of atoms will do over a long period of time. It is impossible in principle to predict what an individual atom will do at any given moment in time. Only over a long time with many atoms can we actually predict that. That randomness in the behavior of an atom can be demonstrated if you've ever heard a Geiger counter clicking near to a radioactive source. That pattern of noise from a Geiger counter is completely random. There is no pattern to it. It occurs at random intervals related to the decay of atoms at random times. We can predict how many clicks we'll hear per second, but not when they will start or when they will end. So that was a fundamental principle of quantum mechanics, and Einstein was a very important founding father of that idea, which was developed, of course, here in Göttingen. Turning now to the experimental verification of the fact that the atom had a structure, then perhaps my other hero of physics, if Einstein is my hero in theoretical physics, Lord Rutherford is my hero in experimental physics. He was a remarkable experimenter who, in 1911, was able to use radium, which Marie Curie had, after years of work in a laboratory in the Sorbonne, had extracted from the ores of uranium. And she used it to bombard atoms with energetic particles, and Rutherford was able to do similar experiments. And for the first time, he was able to see inside the atom, because the wavelength associated with these particles was sufficiently small to allow us to see inside the atom for a first time. Let us demonstrate that for you with a little demonstration. We've brought with us two sources of radiation, but don't worry, they're both completely safe. The first one is a simple torch which generates light radiation, and Jack is going to use it so that you can investigate my body by watching when the torch appears and disappears behind me. As Jack shines the torch, you'll see it appearing and disappearing, and if you like to sketch my body by looking at that appearance and disappearance, you will get a fairly good outline of how I appear. The reason why you can do that is that my body is very much larger than the characteristic wavelength of light. Light is very much smaller, and therefore it can be used to actually outline the object which you're looking at. We've also brought with us a second source of radiation, much more sophisticated and much more expensive, Jack's violin. It generates sound radiation. And Jack will play for you and move round my body. And I suspect you will not be able to hear any difference between what he's playing as he goes before, around, or behind my body. And the reason is that the wavelength characteristic of sound is much bigger than my body. The sound bends around my body and reaches your ears anyway. You cannot distinguish the outline of something my size using sound radiation, which has a much longer wavelength than that you're trying to observe. It's exactly the same in particle physics and nuclear physics. To see something which is very small, you need to use something which is very small, and therefore you need to use particles with a very small wavelength. The wavelength of a particle is inversely proportional to its energy. The more energetic the particle, the smaller its wavelength, the more deeply you can see inside an object like the atom. So Rutherford was able to use the very energetic particles which he obtained from the radium from Marie Curie to see inside the atom for the first time. Here is a schematic of his experiment. The yellow spheres denote atoms of gold, and these atoms of gold were in a thin gold foil. Here you see Rutherford with his student, Geiger, who were doing an experiment in Manchester. Inside this wooden box is the thin gold foil, and the red lines on the picture represent the very energetic particles emitted from the radium, called alpha particles. The alpha particles are very energetic. They can resolve inside the atom. Most of them pass straight through the foil. Every now and again, one is deviated by a small angle, and very rarely indeed, they bounce back in the direction from which they came. By using that information on the relative numbers of particles at different angles, Rutherford was able to use, here you see his notebook, some mathematics. You see he made some mistakes down there, but he managed to get finally the right answer, and was able to show that the atom consists of a very small, very dense atomic nucleus surrounded by a diffuse volume filled with negative charge from electrons. So this discovery of the nucleus in 1911 marks in many ways the start of particle and nuclear physics. Rutherford and Einstein were great friends. They often discussed the latest developments, both in experiments and in theory, that survey conferences, which were began before the First World War, but became particularly important after it, when they brought together scientists from the German-speaking world with the English and French scientists, who of course had been divided by the hostilities of the First World War. Einstein was already by then a major figure in science. Here you see him. There is Lord Rutherford, Cameron Honours. There is Marie Curie. It's not easy, not difficult to pick her out because she's the only one on the picture without facial hair. Not quite true, because that is Moseley from England. I always think I should paint a little moustache on there to make that story work somewhat better. Physics in those days was a man's world, and Marie Curie was very much an exception, but a remarkable exception, one of the very few people ever to win two Nobel Prizes. Here she is talking to Einstein somewhat later in their careers. So Rutherford had discovered the atom had a nucleus, but he again, like Einstein, was not content to rest on his achievements. He was determined to go deeper, to see what the structure of the nucleus was, but he was stuck because he couldn't find any more energetic particles than the ones coming from the radium which Marie Curie had sent him. He needed somehow to accelerate particles to higher energy, but no one knew how to do that. So the next part of the lecture will tell you how Rutherford was able to do that. Now we have another musical interlude, and Jack will play for you some more of Einstein's favorite music by Johann Sebastian Bach, this time the Gavotte en Rondo from the third partita in E major. Rutherford had to find a new mechanism to look deeper inside the atom, to understand the structure of the nucleus. The maximum energy of the particles from radioactive nuclei was too small. He needed to accelerate them. Fortunately, working with him were some extremely brilliant people, and Cockcroft and Walton were able to work out in 1932 how to produce extremely high voltages, very many millions of volts, to accelerate particles. Here is Cockcroft in the laboratory with his beautiful device to increase voltage. It uses all sorts of wonderful things we don't see nowadays, valves and resistance dividers. And with that, he was able to reach millions of volts to accelerate particles. So why do you need to get to very high voltage to accelerate particles? We have another little demonstration for you here, a very sophisticated one. You can tell that no money has been spared on the sophistication of our demonstrations. So Jack will demonstrate for you the mechanism of acceleration in a particle accelerator. So what he's doing is he's transferring electrons from the cloth of his jacket onto the balloon surface, and with that transfer he remains positively charged, so that there's a very strong attractive force between the opposite charges on the balloon and on his hand. And that is essentially all that we're doing when we're accelerating particles in an accelerator. We're using that electrostatic force to accelerate particles as the balloon was accelerated towards Jack's hand. With that and magnetic fields, we can guide and steer particles around an accelerator, and that's the basis for how CERN and all the other accelerators that we have built works. So we needed a very high voltage to transfer a lot of charge to get that acceleration, and that was achieved by Cockcroft and Walton, and here is their original accelerator. So they put a very high voltage difference between the top and the bottom of this. There was a source of radioactive particles in the top, and then you turn on the accelerator, they're accelerated down the tube, and they hit a target behind here, and when the target produces particles, those particles hit a screen in this little contraption here. This is the world's first particle detector, a graduate student in a wooden box. Very sophisticated indeed. This poor gentleman had to sit inside this wooden box with a dark curtain pulled in front of him for 2 hours until his eyes had accommodated to absolute darkness. Then they would switch on the accelerator. The particles which were produced from the nuclear interactions would be sent forward onto a screen which gave a little flash of light every time the particles hit it. By noting down the patterns and how many there were and writing them down, he was then able to give the results to Cockcroft and Walton and Rutherford, and they could then use it to work out some remarkable things. For example, Cockcroft and Walton artificially split the nucleus, and also Chadwick, working with them, discovered the neutral, electrically neutral part of the nucleus, the neutron, and all of them won the Nobel Prize for that work. A graduate student, of course, while the accelerator was turned on, was also being irradiated by energetic particles. One's never sure whether their supervisors told them. Perhaps they did, in order to make sure that they accelerated their writing of their thesis in order to survive. The problem with the Cockcroft-Walton is one which is a limiting factor, and that is a spark. When you get to a certain voltage, the resistance of the air will break down and a spark will pass between the two terminals of the Cockcroft-Walton, and then that will discharge the machine and you have to charge it up again. So there's a limitation with the Cockcroft-Walton accelerator which is just intrinsic to the resistance of air and can't be overcome. So you can only get to a certain voltage. You can only see, therefore, to a certain depth inside the nucleus with the Cockcroft-Walton accelerator. Nevertheless, with that device, they were Cockcroft and Walton and Rutherford were able to make an enormous number of discoveries. It was a golden age for physics in the United Kingdom. There is Rutherford in his laboratory. He had a very loud voice and laugh, and so the students whose apparatus was very sensitive built a sign which says, "Talk softly, please." Whenever he came in to the laboratory, they switched the sign on and it was illuminated, but Rutherford carried on laughing and joking in the same way. He was a remarkable man. I have a very indirect link to Rutherford myself. This is Rutherford's grandson, Peter Fowler. Peter was himself a very distinguished physicist. Rutherford was president of the Royal Society. Peter was a fellow, as I am, and Peter and I were friends and colleagues at the University of Bristol for 20 years until he died about 15 years ago. When you took him into the pub, Peter had a very similar laugh to Rutherford, would occasionally tell you stories of how it felt to sit at the knee of the greatest experimental physicist who ever lived. He died, sadly, in 1937, but already leadership had been passing to the other side of the Atlantic, indeed to the west coast of the United States. In 1930, in Berkeley, a very, very gifted accelerator expert, Lawrence, was developing a new sort of accelerator, the cyclotron, a circular accelerator, not the linear accelerator which had been developed in Cambridge. Here is the first device. in the museum in Berkeley, about the size of a 2 euro piece, about 2 centimeters across. And you see there are, it's battered now because it's been used and destroyed a little bit. But if you look at it schematically, it consists of two parallel plates with Ds, which have got the air pumped out of them. You have an ion source in the middle, and you put layers of charge, negative and then positive, to attract the positive charge coming from the source. And the trick of the accelerator is that every time the particle is bent around to this point here or this point here, you swap the charges so that they're always attracting. They always accelerate the particle, and therefore it keeps gaining energy. As it gains energy, it bends through a larger radius in the magnetic field, and as it gains energy, eventually it will be extracted and can hit the target. So then, the only thing that matters is the size of the magnetic field and the size of this area here, which gives you a larger and larger energy. So if you can build extremely large circular accelerators like this, you can accelerate to higher and higher energies. So there are no longer any physical limitations on these sort of accelerators, as there were for the Cockcroft-Walton, but instead there are limitations which we're all too familiar with today, financial and logistical. Let me illustrate that for you with a time history of the devices which Lawrence built. This is the second of his devices. You see, now he needs a graduate student to help him build it because it's much, much bigger. The bigger the device is, the more energetic the particles, and therefore the deeper inside the nucleus you can probe. Here is his next device. Now he needs a whole team. There you see these Ds. Here is the iron, which is around the electromagnet to bend the particles into a circle. Here is his next device. This is just the iron, which goes around the magnet. Here is his team. There is a very interesting character, which again Arnulf mentioned, J. Robert Oppenheimer, so-called father of the nuclear bomb. After studying here, he went to study with Lawrence at Caltech. Here is his final device. And you can start to see why it was his final device. In fact, this is the largest electromagnet you can build, which can be supported from any feasible ceiling made of concrete. So this was the end of the road. You see that already the military in the US was starting to fund this enormous expenditure because they began to realize that there were applications for these sort of studies in terms of weapons manufacture. Fortunately, people were smart and they realized that there was another cleverer way to produce a very large magnetic field. They split this magnet into lots of smaller magnets and threaded a vacuum pipe between them, and then they could keep particles in the same orbit by increasing the magnetic field, ramping it up to match the energy of the particles. And that is indeed the basis for all subsequent accelerators, an evacuated ring with lots of magnets around them. And as you'll see, that is the structure of the Large Hadron Collider. So we've left Einstein a little bit in this discussion. What was he doing? Well, he was in Princeton at that time, occupied with a search for a unified theory of physics, where all of the interactions and phenomena could be unified under a single framework. Now we are aware that that was a fruitless task, and indeed he wasted much of his time on this task for the latter half of his career, although he did some many very other useful and exciting things. But he was very influential, and indeed he kept in close contact with the people like Lawrence and Fermi who were building the accelerators and understanding what their implications were. And indeed in 1939 he was approached by Leo Szilard and several others to write to the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to warn him of the possibility that the Nazis were developing an atomic bomb. And this is a copy of the famous letter which he wrote to Roosevelt in 1939. Let me just read you one line from this letter. "I understand that Germany has actually stopped the sale of uranium from the Czechoslovakian mines, which she has taken over." He's warning Roosevelt that Germany is stockpiling uranium. The only reason that Germany would have to stockpile uranium would be to build an atomic bomb, and it was this realization which it needed someone like Einstein with enormous influence to make, which converted Roosevelt to the idea that it was possible to build an atomic weapon and therefore to start the American and British program to build an atomic bomb. This led to Einstein's least favorite sobriquet, least favorite name. He was called the father of the atom bomb. He hated that. He was a pacifist for almost all of his life until 1933, and he strongly opposed the use of atomic bombs in anger in war. Nevertheless, it is true that, as is shown on this cover of Time magazine, E equals MC squared is the basis for the nuclear bomb, and indeed Einstein was the originator of that equation, so he cannot escape all responsibility for that development. His final years were in some ways sad. He was increasingly disillusioned with the uncertainty which was inherent in the quantum mechanics which he'd done so much to found. He famously said that he did not believe that God played dice with the universe. So he retreated into this fruitless quest to unify all of the interactions of physics without using the basic principles of quantum mechanics, which we now believe are fundamental to understand how the universe worked. Here he is in his study in Princeton just before he died. This is the last photograph which was taken of him outside the house in Mercer Street. Jack and I visited Princeton a few years ago to give a lecture, and we were fortunate enough to see the house in Princeton where he died. He was taken into hospital, and still a few hours before he died, he was writing down equations for his unified theory. He died in 1955, needless to say, without success. So what has happened then in the 50 years since Einstein died? What have we done? Einstein's legacy tells us what we have to do. We have to explore the universe at the smaller scales by accelerating particles to the highest energy, because as we've seen, the wavelength characterized by particles decreases as the energy increases. As wavelength drops, you can see smaller and smaller things, and therefore we can probe deeper and deeper inside matter. One of the things which we've been doing in those 50 years, indeed I spent most of my career doing, was to investigate the structure of the proton by doing the Rutherford experiment again with much higher energy particles at much shorter wavelengths. And using that, we've been able to understand the structure of the proton. But perhaps more exciting is the idea that you can also annihilate matter with antimatter to create new particles from the energy produced. And let me show you diagrammatically how that works. If you imagine accelerating a particle like an electron with an antiparticle and bringing them into collision together, then Einstein tells us that when they collide, E equals mc squared means that their energy is converted eventually back into matter. And if the energy which we bring into the collision is sufficiently large, we can produce particles with enough mass that they can be seen for the first time since the first fractions of a second after the Big Bang. So using these sort of annihilations, we can try to understand how the universe works by recreating the first fractions of a second after the Big Bang. Another musical physicist, Richard Feynman, who played the bongo drums, had a nice musical analogy for trying to understand the universe by colliding particles together and annihilating them. He reckoned it was rather like trying to understand the structure of a grand piano by colliding two together and listening to the noise they make when they collide. That's a good analogy, except that the particles and the structures we're trying to understand are much more complex than those of a grand piano. So, in the next part of the lecture, I'm going to explain to you everything we've done in particle physics, our understanding of the universe from the very basic principles after the Big Bang, in two slides. So, to prepare yourselves for that, we have another musical interlude, this time from a composer who was actually a great friend of Albert Einstein's, as Jack will explain to you.
Albert Einstein was, well, one of the most famous men in the world, and I think one of the ways he particularly enjoyed his fame, I don't think he was very interested in being famous, but one of the ways he did enjoy his fame was to be able to mix with other people in other fields that were sort of equivalent levels. And Fritz Kreisler was one of the great violinists of the early 20th century, and he and Albert Einstein became friends, and no doubt Einstein would give Kreisler the odd physics lecture and all the way around violin lessons. So I'm going to play a piece of Fritz Kreisler. He was also a great composer, so I'm going to play a piece of his called The Scherzo. Thank you.
everything we've learned since Einstein died about how the universe works in two slides. Get ready. So we believe that the universe is made up of very small, tiny fundamental particles which are acted on by a very small number of fundamental interactions. And here are the four forces which we believe make up how the universe works. The first is most familiar to you, the force of gravity. Gravity is, of course, what controls how the Earth turns around the Sun, how the apple falls on Newton's head, and which controls what happens if you throw a projectile from one corner of the room to the other. Without the force of gravity, that ball would have carried on in a straight line. Of course, it would have hit the window, but in principle, it would have carried on forever into outer space. It's gravity which controls it, which brings it back down so that Jack can catch it. Gravity feels to us extremely strong, but in fact, in terms of atoms and subatomic particles which we're interested in, then gravity is entirely negligible. It's so weak we don't bother to calculate it when we're doing calculations in elementary particle physics. So why is it that gravity seems so strong to us but is so weak in terms of elementary particles? And the answer is that as far as we know, there is no such thing as anti-gravity. Every particle attracts every other particle. Between two atoms, the force is negligible. Between all the billions of billions of atoms which make up your bodies or which make up everything we see around us in the room, that force adds every time you add another particle and becomes sufficiently large that it indeed seems to be the dominant force which we feel in our lives. The second interaction, which is also familiar to you, is what controls magnets, what happens when lightning strikes, what happens if you put an electric plug into a socket and drive electrons from one side to the other. Electromagnetism, again, feels extremely strong, but only if you were so silly as to put your fingers into the plug, because it turns out that in most objects, there are an equal number of electrons and positive charges, so it balances out, and therefore electromagnetism doesn't seem as important to us as gravity does, because most things around us are electrically neutral. The remaining two forces are less familiar but equally important in how the universe works. The strong force is responsible for holding together the atomic nucleus. The atomic nucleus consists of positively charged particles, the protons, and neutral particles, the neutrons. The electric charge on the protons pushes them apart. We've seen that like charges push apart, just like opposite charges on the balloon in Jack's hand attract. The opposite charges pushing apart would make all nuclei disintegrate, would make no atoms stable, and therefore we wouldn't exist, and the universe would be a very boring place filled only with microwave background radiation at almost the absolute zero of temperature. Fortunately for us, the strong force counteracts that tendency for positive charges to push apart. It confines the protons and neutrons inside the nucleus and leads to stable atoms and therefore allows us to exist. The weak force is much weaker than the strong force, but nevertheless equally important. It controls the decay of heavy particles into light particles. The neutron in the nucleus is slightly unstable. In free space, it decays to a proton with a lifetime of a few minutes. That is mediated by the weak force. It's that force which is responsible for radioactivity, for how the sun burns. Without it, there would be no stars, and yet again, the universe would be a very boring place with nothing in it except microwave background radiation. Indeed, it's the exquisite balance between these four forces which gives the enormous diversity and structure we see around us in the universe. If any of these forces were only slightly different by a tiny, tiny amount, the universe would look extraordinarily different. Mostly, it would look like a very boring place filled with nothing except radiation. We live in a very interesting universe where the structures we see around us are possible. Not many possible universes would exist like this. So those are the four forces, and that balance between them determines how the universe evolves. What do these forces act upon? They act upon a very small number of elementary particles, point-like elementary particles. Here are all the particles which make up the matter you see around us. Everything in you and I, everything which exists inside the things we can see with our senses, is made up just of these three particles. The up and the down quarks make up the proton and neutron. A proton consists of two up quarks and a down quark. A neutron consists of two down quarks and an up quark. Therefore, these things are what's in the atomic nucleus. Orbiting the atomic nucleus are electrons, and it's the interaction of clouds of electrons which gives rise to all of the science of chemistry and biology. The fourth particle, the ghostly neutrino, is being emitted from the sun and passing through us millions of neutrinos per second are passing through this room as we sit here. They almost never interact, and when they do interact, it's of interest only to particle physicists, but almost all of them pass straight through us, through the Earth, and off to the other side of the universe. So the neutrino is produced extremely copiously, but doesn't interact at all. So everything that we can see around us is made up only of these four particles. So it's a deep mystery why nature has chosen to produce a second copy of those particles, identical in every respect to its partner on this side of the board, except that these ones are much more massive, much heavier than these ones on this side. Otherwise, they're identical. They have the same electric charge, the same interactions, but they're much heavier. We can only produce these in very energetic accelerators or in the very first fractions of a second after the Big Bang. Nevertheless, they're essential to how the universe works, and each of these is a copy of the of its friend on the left, except with more mass. Even more peculiarly, nature chooses to produce a third of these generations. Remember, only these ones are used in the matter we see around us. This one, indeed, is so heavy that it has the same mass as an atom of gold. That might not seem so surprising, except that in the best electron microscopes, you can take photographs of atoms actually vibrating in lattice sites. Whereas this particle, which has the same mass as an atom of gold, has no size whatever. It's a Euclidean point in the sense that Euclid meant a point, that which has no breadth. How can something with no size have enormous mass? Well, if you know the answer to that question, you should write a paper, because you will certainly get a Nobel Prize. No one else in the world understands how this is. But being physicists, we're very pragmatic. We calculate what the answer is. And remarkably, with this theory called the Standard Model, we get incredibly good predictions for all of the things we've been able to observe so far with all of the experiments we've done in the 50 years since Einstein died. The forces that we showed on the other slide are carried by also point-like particles. The W and the Z particle carry the weak interaction. They're very massive, and that indeed is the reason why the weak interaction is so weak. The photon carries the electromagnetic interaction. It's just everyday light. As you're watching this lecture, photons are bouncing off the screen and going into your eye, and you're observing them and converting them into information. The final carrier of the force is the gluon. The gluon is the force which sticks together the quarks inside the proton and the proton and neutron inside the nucleus. So this is the Standard Model, tremendously successful, the most successful theory in science in terms of the accuracy of its predictions. But there's a missing element to it, and indeed, if these are the building blocks of the universe, without this missing element, these building blocks will collapse in a heap on our floor. So we need to fill that gap, and the gap we need to fill, we believe, is something called the Higgs boson, a particle who is essential to give all of these particles a mass. Without this, or something very similar to it, then none of these particles would have a mass. And if none of these particles had a mass, neither would we. And yet again, the universe would be extraordinarily different, boring, filled with nothing but microwave background radiation. So there is the Standard Model. Let's assume the reason we haven't seen the Higgs boson yet is it's so heavy we've not been able to actually see it in anything but our most energetic accelerators. But as I mentioned at the end of the lecture, we hope, perhaps even tomorrow, to have news that the Higgs boson has finally been sighted. If the Higgs boson was found, then the Standard Model would be complete, but it's still obviously and patently wrong. Why is it patently wrong? Because it doesn't include the force of gravity. Nowhere in the Standard Model is there any mention of how gravity is carried between particles. And the reason for that is a deep mathematical incompatibility between Einstein's theory of general relativity, which we use to describe gravity, and the quantum mechanics, which we use to describe the Standard Model. And indeed, it was that deep incompatibility which led to Einstein spending the last 30 years of his life trying to understand how to unify gravity with a much simpler version of the Standard Model that he knew in his day. He failed, and we still haven't succeeded, although we have some ideas as to how that might actually work. So that's everything we know about the universe. We've been able to use that to chart the development of the universe from the very first fractions of a second after the Big Bang, which began the universe, to the present day with remarkable success. The Standard Model of cosmology and particle physics is one of the great intellectual achievements of the 20th century. But we know we need to go further. We know we need to find out what lies behind this Standard Model, because it's incomplete, it has many assumptions, and it doesn't work when we need to include gravity. So how do we do that new experiment? How do we find things beyond the Standard Model? We need to build, as we've seen, energetic accelerators, accelerators which can take us to the energy frontier, take us beyond where we've been able to reach with our accelerators to date. And this Large Hadron Collider There you see it beneath the plain of Geneva, somewhere between 50 and 175 meters beneath the plain of Geneva, is where we're doing the experiment, which we hope will first of all discover the Higgs, but also tell us what lies beyond the Standard Model. CERN lies on the border between France and Switzerland. It passes right through the middle of the laboratory. It's a remarkable example of international collaboration stretching back over almost 60 years. The LHC itself is an amazing feat of engineering. 27 kilometers in circumference, it contains some of the most high-tech equipment in the world. 31,000 tons of magnets, 12 million tons of liquid nitrogen required to cool them down. Here you see the dipole magnets, which bend the particles around in the circle, bring them into collision in the experiments. These dipoles have to be connected together, and you can see there the connections between two of these magnets. They're very complex, and indeed it was a failure in one of the many tens of thousands of connections of these magnets, which led to the LHC being broken for a mole in the year 2 or 3 years ago. But I'm delighted to say it's now working extremely well, and here is a view in the LHC tunnel which shows you the magnets stretching out around the curvature there of the tunnel, coming around in a circle and bringing the particles to collision. How does the LHC work? We essentially use old accelerators. I, in fact, did my PhD thesis on this accelerator here, and now we use it to inject particles at larger and larger energies into the Large Hadron Collider. Bunches of many billions of protons are accelerated and then brought eventually into collision in experiments which sit around the circumference of the LHC. One in particular we'll concentrate on, the ATLAS experiment, which is also what my friends and colleagues in Göttingen work on. Here you see what happens when the protons collide. They produce many hundreds of particles of different energies, and what we need to do is to reconstruct those particles to essentially take a photograph of them if we're to understand the interactions and the forces which give rise to those interactions. So what we need to do is to measure the energy and momentum of each of these particles and then computerize it and use it to reconstruct what's happened in the accelerator. So you see the enormous number of collisions we get per second. And that means that it's extremely difficult to photograph these interactions. This background is actually a photograph from my thesis. It's a bubble chamber where bubbles form around particles as they pass through liquid hydrogen. And there's an interaction here. We could use an actual camera to photograph these because they happened once every 3 or 4 times a second. With the enormous frequency of the LHC, we can't use an actual camera. We have to use a digitization into a computer. And that measures the energy and momentum of all the produced particles. And then by using the equations of special relativity, we can work out the features of each of the collisions. The unfortunate thing is that there are 25 collisions at the full specification of the LHC, 40 million times per second. More, even worse, most of the events which are produced at this enormous rate are from physics we already understand. Only very, very rarely do we get to the really large energies where we want to see new particles and new phenomena. Only indeed 1 in a billion of the interactions that occur at the LHC is of interest. So we need to throw away almost all of the interactions, and we need to decide which of these 1 in a billion is of interest in this tiny fraction of a second. So the computing power and the electronics which is required at these experiments is enormous, and indeed the data flowing around the ATLAS detector is similar to the total telecoms traffic of a large European country. Even when you've thrown away almost all of the particles, you still need to store 1 gigabyte, 1 billion bytes of data per second, which if you were to store it on CD-ROMs and stack them one on top of the other, would reach a height more than Mount Everest within a year. So fortunately, we don't use that technology, but even now, the storage of this enormous amount of data is very difficult. Let me try to explain for you very briefly the two main types of detector we use to do this photography of the events which we produce at the LHC. There are two main types: tracking detectors, which look at charged particles, electrically charged particles, and calorimeters, which are sensitive to the energy of all particles. This semiconductor tracker is the one which is very close to my heart because it was built in Oxford by my group in Oxford, who worked with Japan in the 10-year international program of development to assemble the silicon wafers which are used in this very accurate detector. Here you see the robot assembling these detectors around a cylinder, which is then placed in the heart of the ATLAS detector. Here is one of the wafers. In fact, there are two glued back to back at a small angle. There are lines ruled across these devices, tens of microns apart, with aluminium on them. And by looking at the deposition of charge as a particle passes through this silicon, you can then reconstruct its position in three dimensions and digitize it using the electronics shown here. Because this electronics is running very fast to digitize the events many millions of times per second, the electronics gets very hot, so you need to collect cooling pipes, and here is a technician connecting a cooling pipe around the outside of the detector, and here is the final detector, just as it's about to be shipped to CERN to be assembled inside the center of ATLAS itself. Let me try to give you a feeling for how large the ATLAS detector is. Here is a computer model of the ATLAS detector, cut so that one quarter has been removed, so you can see right into the center of it. This area here is, in fact, the area of the semiconductor tracker, and let me show you a little computer reconstruction which shows an ideal physicist walking through the center of the detector. Of course, impossible in practice, but it will give you an idea of the overall scale of the device. So here comes the computer-generated physicist walking through the center of the detector. There's the semiconductor tracker, which I showed you. Let's try her again. She might get a bit further this time. So here she is walking through the detector. Then the computer will start to pan out to give you an idea of the overall size of the ATLAS detector. So the entire cabin, which is about the size of Cologne Cathedral, is filled with sophisticated electronics and devices to detect the charged particles and the neutral particles as they emerge from the interaction point. So let me now give you an idea of how this construction works with two sequences of time-lapse photography. The first is, we'll show you the inner tracking chamber of ATLAS, which contains the semiconductor tracker, which I showed you before, being inserted into the next largest piece of apparatus, in this case the calorimeter, which detects electrons and photons. This was made in the United States, where they build things in inches, and this was made in Europe, where we build things in centimeters, and so there's obviously some interest in making sure that these two fit together without banging into each other. There's only 2 millimeters of clearance between the outer vessel of this device and the inner vessel of this one, so what you'll see is, with a very speeded-up camera, them trying to make sure that you can get one device inside another before they're both installed in the ATLAS detector. And the second piece of photography is, again, time-lapse, where you see one photograph per day taken inside the ATLAS hall as the ATLAS detector was being assembled. So each of the photographs, as it appears before you, will be one day between the two stills. And so you'll see, you get an impression of how this enormous international collaboration of several thousand physicists and engineers actually can conclude and build a detector of this complexity in CERN. So to accompany that, Jack will play for you some more of Einstein's favorite music. This time he will play for you the Preludio from the E major Partita.
Thank you.
So finally, what might we find at this remarkable instrument that we've built in Geneva? Of course, the most likely thing we will find is something we've never thought of, even in our wildest dreams, and that isn't a facile remark. It's been my experience in more than 30 years of experimental particle physics that when we build new accelerators, often what we find is by far more interesting than what we thought we were designing them for in the first place. But one thing that we do know we ought to see at the Large Hadron Collider is this famous Higgs particle, which I told you about, which gives mass to all the other particles, invented by a very distinguished professor at Edinburgh University in the United Kingdom, Peter Higgs, who in the 1960s postulated that the whole universe was filled with a field which somehow pushes against particles, most particles, giving them some sort of mass which therefore slows them down. And that mechanism is then the mechanism by which the quarks and the leptons of our standard model gain their mass. So that's one thing we think we should see. Another thing we might see, but no one is certain, is a solution to this strange notion that all of the quarks and leptons have no size, that they're point-like. Perhaps they're in fact just very tiny one-dimensional objects made of quantum material called strings. If a symmetry of nature called supersymmetry exists, then it's possible to construct for the first time a theoretical model in which, rather than being points, all of the particles in the standard model are rather tiny one-dimensional objects which oscillate. These oscillations give rise to their different masses, and superstring theory naturally unifies gravity with all the other forces and therefore finally realizes Einstein's dream of unifying all the forces in one overarching theory. If superstrings do exist, then they could collide in the LHC, and if they do, they would form mini black holes identical to the black hole which we think sits at the center of our galaxy. But fortunately for us, they won't suck us all into them as the black holes in the galaxy do. Rather, they will evaporate, rather like dropping a piece of water onto a very hot plate will evaporate almost immediately. Similarly, these black holes would evaporate into thousands of particles by a process called Hawking radiation, invented by perhaps the second most famous physicist in the world, Stephen Hawking, who was educated at Oxford but then spent most of his career in this very obscure institution on the east coast of England that is not talked about in polite company. Stephen's theory tells us that these black holes would evaporate into many thousands of particles in a very striking pattern which would be immediately visible to the detectors like ATLAS and the other sister detector, CMS. So let me now finish by just bringing you up to date with what's happening at the LHC. Last year, the LHC performed beautifully. This is a measure of here of every day, how many collisions of protons there were recorded at the ATLAS detector, and you see that from a very small beginning down at the beginning of last year, we got to a stage where we were achieving about a factor of 20 more collisions, and that was just as the accelerator physicists learned better and better how to handle the beams inside the LHC, which are very difficult to control absolutely. Using that data, it's now possible that we're starting to see the Higgs pattern. Don't worry about this very complicated plot. All of these different colors present regions in mass. This is the mass of the Higgs particle in GeV. One proton, which we've looked at before, is about one of these GeV in mass. So we're at 100 times the mass of the proton. Almost all of these colored areas are ruled out for where the Higgs particle might be. Only the white area remains still a possibility. And indeed, at a press conference in Geneva tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we will hear whether or not, with the data which has been taken this year, indeed there is evidence that the Higgs particle really exists and is inside that region. And we have every reason to believe Arnulf knows, but is not allowed to tell us, what will be announced tomorrow morning. So watch your newspapers tomorrow or the day after. Is there any sign of these black holes that we're looked for and which Hawking told us would evaporate? If they existed, then they would show the red line here. The black lines represent the data from the ATLAS collaboration. It doesn't seem to have this very large structure out here. It falls as the Monte Carlo, as the theory would predict, and therefore as yet there's no sign of superstrings or micro black holes, but who knows what we might eventually see. So LHC has restarted in 2012, and here is the data which has been taken. It's now shut down, and there's some machine physics going on. But already, actually, this is rather an old plot. Already, the LHC has taken more than the data which was taken all of last year in just the first 2 months of running. It's also running at a rather higher energy, 8 TeV rather than 7 TeV. And in just over this month, they've already taken more data than in 2011. So we're expecting a very exciting announcement tomorrow at 9 o'clock. So let me try to summarize what we've tried to show you in this lecture. Firstly, that the work of Albert Einstein, his basic understanding of how the universe works, is still the basis on which we understand all of physics and the evolution of the universe. His work lives on, and the equations which he produced back in 1905 are still used millions of times a day all over the world. I use them when I'm doing real particle physics. I often forget that Einstein produced them because they're second nature to almost all physicists and many chemists working in modern science. Perhaps even more important for us as human beings is his example. He worked tirelessly for peace, he loved human dignity, he loved music, and that remains an inspiration to all who come across his example. The LHC, as we've seen, will continue Einstein's legacy. It will shine light into totally unknown regions. There will be surely false trails and surprises, but there will also be exciting discoveries, perhaps even tomorrow morning. In the next few years, we will make significant progress towards realizing Einstein's dream. That dream was inspired by his love of music. He believed that the universe could be explained as simply and beautifully as the music which inspired him, the music of Bach and Mozart. That's the end of the formal part of the lecture, but we have one more piece of entertainment for you, another piece of music, and Jack will explain for you what that is. It's my opportunity to emulate Einstein. As a physicist, Einstein was a giant, and I'm a pygmy, but he wasn't a terribly good violinist, and neither am I. And so we're going to end by playing a duet, just as Einstein would have played duets with the great violinists of his day.
Sie hörten den Hamburger Physiker Brian Forster im Rahmen der Ringvorlesung zum 275. Jubiläum der Universität Göttingen. Sprach er über Einsteins Universe. Die Einführung kam vom Göttinger Physiker Arnulf Quadt.